Each day, Sean set aside an hour or so to discuss with Mark the objects and priorities of the expedition. They drew up a list, which was added to daily, and as it grew, so did Sean Courtney's enthusiasm. More than once he broke off to shake his head and grumble, "Ah, you're a lucky blighter. What I wouldn't give to be your age again and to be going back into the bush." "Hey, you could come and visit me," Mark smiled. "Yeah, I might just do that," Sean agreed, and then resettled his spectacles on his nose to bring up the next point for discussion. The first of Mark's tasks was to compile an estimate of what species of wild animals still existed in the proclaimed area, and how many of each there were. Clearly, this was one of the utmost importance to any attempt at protection and conservation. All would depend on there being sufficient wildlife surviving to make their efforts worthwhile. "It may already be too late in the afternoon," Sean pointed out. "No," Mark would not even listen to the suggestion. "There's game there. Just enough to give us a chance, I'm sure of it." Next important was for him to contact the people living in the area of Charker's Gate, the Zulus grazing cattle along the edge of the Tsetsefly Belt, the native hunters and gatherers living within the belt, each wandering group, each village, each headman, each chief, and hold discussions with them, gauging the attitude of the Zulu peoples to the stricter administration of the proclaimed area and warning them that what for many years they and their ancestors had looked upon as commonage and tribal hunting ground was under new control. Men were no longer free to cut timber and thatch, to gather and hunt at will. Mark's intimate knowledge of the Zulu language would serve him well here. It was to build temporary accommodation for himself and conduct a survey to choose the final site for a permanent warden's post. There were 50 other tasks less important, but no less demanding. It was a program to excite and intrigue Mark and make him want to begin. And as the day drew nearer, only one cloud lay dark and heavy on the splendid horizon ahead of him. He would be parting from storm. But he consoled himself with the sure knowledge that it would not be for long. He was going ahead into Eden to prepare a place for his Eve. As Storm watched him sleep flat on his back, spread like a crucifix on the forest floor, without even the cotton underpants between him and nature, the possessive smile of a mother watching over the child at her breast warmed and softened Storm's lips. She was naked also, her clothing scattered around them like the petals of an overblown rose, thrown there by the storm winds of passion which were now spent and quiescent. She sat over him cross-legged on the corner of the plaid rug, and she studied his face, wondering at how young he looked in sleep, feeling a choking of tenderness in her throat, and the soft melting afterglow of love deep in her body where he had been. She leaned over him, and her breasts swung forward with a new weightiness, the tips darker and wrinkled like small pinky brown raisins. She dipped her shoulders and let the nipples brush lightly across his face, and smiled again as he screwed up his nose and pursed his lips in his sleep, snorting as if to blow away a bothersome fly. He came awake suddenly, and as he reached for her, she squealed softly and plucked her breasts away from him, slapping at his hands. "Unhand me, sir, this instant," she commanded. And he caught her and pulled her down onto his chest, so that she could hear his heart beating under her ear. She snuggled down, making throaty little sounds of comfort. He sighed deeply, and his chest swelled and expanded under her cheek, and she heard the air rush into his lungs. "Mark?" she said.
"I'm here."
"You're not going. You know that, don't you?" The air in his lungs stayed there as he held his breath, and the hand that was stroking lightly up from the small of her back to the nape of her neck stilled. She could feel the tension in his fingers. They stayed like that for many seconds, and then he let the air out of his lungs with an explosive grunt.
"What do you mean?" he asked. "Where am I not going?"
"This place up there in the bush," she said.
"Charker's Gate?"
"Yes, you're not going."
"Why not?"
"Because I forbid it."
He sat up abruptly, joggling her roughly off his chest. They sat facing each other, and he was staring at her with such an expression that she ran her fingers through her hair then folded her arms across her breasts, covering them protectively. "Storm, what on earth are you talking about?" he demanded.
"I don't want you to waste any more time," she told him. "You must start making your way now if you're ever going to amount to anything."
"This is my way, our way," he said, bewildered. "We agreed on it. I will go up there to Sharker's Gate and build our home."
"Home?"
She was truly appalled.
"Up there in the bush? Me in a grass hut? Mark, are you out of your mind?"
"But I thought..." "What are you going to do is to start making some money," she told him fiercely. And picking up her blouse, she pulled it over her head, and as her tousled head emerged, she went on, "And forget about little boys' games."
"I will be making money."
His expression was stiff and becoming hostile.
"What money?" she asked, just as frostily.
"Well, I'll have a salary."
"A salary?"
She flung back her head and gave a high peal of scornful laughter.
"A salary, forsooth! How much?"
"I don't know," he admitted. "It isn't really all that important."
"You're a child, Mark, do you know that? A salary, £20 a week. Can you really and truly imagine me living on your salary?"
She gave the word a world of contempt.
"Do you know who earns salaries? Mr. Smathers earns a salary."
She was on her feet now, hopping furiously on one leg as she drew on her knickers.
"Daddy's foreman at the sawmills earn salaries. The servants that wait on the table, the stable grooms, earn salaries."
She was pulling up her riding breeches, and with them all her dignity.
"Real men don't earn salaries, Mark." Her voice was high and shrill. "You know what real men do, don't you?"
He was buttoning the fly of his breeches also, forced to follow her example. And he shook his head silently.
"Real men pay salaries, not take them," she said. "Do you know that when my father was your age, he was already a millionaire?"
Mark was never able to fathom what it was that triggered him. Perhaps the mention of Sean at that particular moment. But suddenly he lost his temper. He felt it like a hot red fog behind his eyes.
"I'm not your bloody father," he shouted. "Don't you swear at my father," she shouted back. "He's five times the man you'll ever be."
They were both panting and flushed. Clothing rumpled, half-clad, with wild hair and wilder eyes glaring at each other like animals, speechless with hurt and anger. Storm made the effort. She swallowed painfully and held out her hands, palm upwards.
"Listen, Mark, I've got it all planned. If you went into timber, selling to the mines, Daddy would give you the agency and we could live in Johannesburg."
But Mark's anger was still on him, and his voice was rough and scaly with it.
"Thank you," he said. "Then I could spend my life grubbing money for you and buy those ridiculous clothes and..."
"Don't you insult me, Mark Anders," she blazed.
"I'm me," Mark told her. "And that's what I'm going to be the rest of my life. If you loved me, you'd respect that. And if you loved me, you wouldn't want me to live in a grass hut."
"I love you," he shouted her down. "But you'll be my wife and you'll do what I decide."
"Don't challenge me, Mark Anders, I warn you. Don't ever do that."
"I'll be your husband," he began. But she snatched up her boots and ran to her horse, stooping to loose the hobble and then flinging herself onto its back barefooted and looked down at him. She was breathless with anger, but she struggled to make her voice icy and cutting.
"Don't take any bets on that."
And she dragged the horse's head around and kicked him into a run.
"Where's Missy?"
Sean demanded as he unfolded his napkin and tucked the corner into his waistcoat, glancing at Storm's empty place at the table.
"She's not feeling very well, dear,"
Ruth told him, as she began serving the soup, ladling it out of the fat-bellied tureen in a cloud of fragrant steam.
"I allowed her to have her dinner sent up to her room."
"Oh, what's wrong with her?" Sean looked up with concern, creasing his forehead.
"Oh, it's nothing serious,"
said Ruth firmly, closing the door on further discussion. Sean stared at her for a moment, and then understanding dawned.
"Oh,"
he said. The functions of the female body had always been shrouded for Sean Courtney in deepest mystery, and awakened in him an abiding awe.
"Oh,"
he said again, and leaned forward to blow noisily on a spoonful of soup to cover his embarrassment and the niggling resentment that his beloved child was a child no longer. Across the table, Mark applied himself to his spoon with equal determination, but with an empty, aching feeling below his ribs.
"Where is Missy tonight?" Sean asked, with what was for him a certain diffidence. "Still not well?"
"She telephoned Irene Lushars this morning. Apparently the Lushars are having a huge party tonight and she wanted to go. She left after lunch. She's driving herself back to Durban in the Cadillac."
"Where will she stay?" Sean demanded.
"With the Lushars, naturally."
"She should have asked me," Sean frowned.
"Well, you were down at the sawmills all day, dear. The decision had to be made immediately, or she would have missed the party. I knew you wouldn't mind."
Sean minded everything that took his daughter away from him, but he could not say so now. "I thought she hated Irene Lushars," he complained.
"That was last month," said Ruth.
"I thought she was sick," Sean persisted.
"Oh, that was last night."
"Oh, when is she coming home?"
"She may stay in town for the race meeting at Greville on Saturday."
Mark Anders listened with the empty space in his chest turning to a great bottomless void. Storm had gone back to join that close group of rich, indolent and privileged young people, to their endless games and their eternal round of extravagant partying. And on Saturday, Mark was leaving with two mules for the wilderness beyond Charker's Gate.
Mark would never fathom how Dirk Courtney knew. To him it seemed further evidence of the man's power, the tentacles of his influence that reached into every corner and crevice.
"I understand you are to make the survey for the government, to decide whether it's worth developing the proclaimed area beyond Charker's Gate," he asked Mark.
Mark could still hardly believe the fact that he stood unarmed and completely unprotected here at Great Longwood. His skin tingled with warning of deadly danger. His nerves were drawn like bowstrings, and he walked with exaggerated care, one hand clenched in the hip pocket of his breeches.
Beside him, Dirk Courtney was tall and courteous and affable. When he turned to make that statement, he smiled, a warm spread of the wide and handsome mouth, and he laid a hand on Mark's upper arm, a light but friendly touch, which shocked Mamba as though a mumba had kissed him with its little flickering black tongue.
"How does he know it?" Mark stared at him, his feet slowing, so that he pulled gently away from Dirk's touch.
If Dirk noticed the withdrawal, it did not show in his smile, and he let his hand fall naturally to his side and took the flat silver cigarette case from his jacket pocket. "Try one," he murmured. "They're made specially for me."
Mark tasted the incense of the sweetish Turkish tobacco, using the act of lighting the cigarette to cover his uncertainty and surprise. Only Sean Courtney and his close family knew, and of course the Prime Minister's office. The Prime Minister's office, if that was it, as it seemed it must be, then Dirk Courtney's tentacle stretched far indeed.
"Your silence I must take as confirmation," Dirk told him, as they came down the paved alleyway between two lines of whitewashed loose boxes. From over the half-doors the horses stretched out their necks to Dirk, and he paused now and then to caress a velvety muzzle with surprisingly gentle fingers, and to murmur an endearment.
"You are a very silent young man," Dirk smiled, that warm, endearing smile again. "I like a man who can keep his own counsel and respect the privacy of others."
He turned to confront Mark, forcing him to meet his eyes.
Dirk reminded Mark of some glossy cat, one of the big predators, not the tabby domestic variety. The leopard, golden and beautiful and cruel. He wondered at his own courage or foolhardiness in coming here, right into the leopard's lair. A year ago it might have been suicidal to put himself in this man's hands. Even now, without Sean Courtney's protection, he would never have dared. Yet although it was logical to believe that nobody, not even Dirk Courtney, would dare touch him, now that he was Sean's protégé, with all that that implied, yet prickles of apprehension nettled his spine as he looked into those leopard's eyes. Dirk took his elbow, not giving him opportunity to avoid the touch, and led him through a gateway to the stud pens. The two pens were enclosed with 10-foot-high pole fences, carefully padded to prevent damage to the expensive animals that would be confined there. The earth within the rectangular enclosures was ankle-deep with fresh sawdust, and though one was empty, there was a group of four grooms busy in the nearest pen.